Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, the colors and songs of the summer and what they say about us.
And who should get a COVID booster this fall and who can get one.
But first, come Monday, the Arizona Republic will be losing some longtime voices. Among those who recently took Gannett's buyout is Mary Jo Pitzel, who's been a reporter at the Republic for more than four decades. She's covered everything from education to the environment to child safety to the state capitol, among other beats.
When she came by the studio to chat recently, she emphasized that it was her decision to step away, although she said it's also not really a retirement for her.
Pitzel spoke with our co-host Mark Brody, who asked what comes to mind for her when she thinks about her time at the paper.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, so many things. And it'll probably hit me, you know, after I formally leave the paper in early September. But just the change, you know, how much has changed. I mean, I've worked in two different buildings. We've moved from one to another, and the newsrooms, I think, is going to be moving to a new location next year. But, you know, I came on to a staff as a fresh out of college, you know, kiddo from Nebraska into this big staff. I was hired at a time of a lot of expansion of the newspaper, mm-hmm. which opened up a lot of opportunity. So my first beat was covering North Phoenix. You know, I remember writing about a big tree that was a gathering spot for young kids in Bruce Babbitt's neighborhood. years later, I was in a courtroom. Bruce Babbitt's son, who remembered the tree, all grown up, an attorney, he stopped me and said, I remember that story.
Wow.
So that's one thing that strikes me is that what you write, you just never know what's going to stick with people. I mean, this was, you know, it was a little neighborhoody kind of story, but
yeah.
it made an impression on people. And it's nice to have that be recognized.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Well, and you've done so many different things. Mm. I mean, you've been covering the legislature and state government a few times. You've done education. You've done a lot of neighborhood stuff. So many different things. How do you transition? How did you go from covering one thing to something totally different?
Well, sometimes reluctantly, but I've really never had an assignment that I didn't fall in love with. And I still look very fondly on the environment. That is just the greatest assignment to have because it's in this fantastic state. And I loved all the wildlife stuff particularly. But my first week or two on the environment beat, the Rodeo Chetiskay fire went out.
Yeah.
I knew nothing about forest fires.
And that's the challenge, right? You get assigned to a new beat and you may or may not forget about knowing who to talk to. You might not even know what's happening.
Yeah. So you scramble, you know, I mean, we do get training. We are professionals. And so you sort of jump in and you scramble and it's good.
You must have met over the course of your career some just truly fascinating people.
Of course. I guess for bragging rights, you know, because I've been asked this over the years, you know, probably the most famous person I've ever interviewed was Mother Teresa.
Wow.
This was back when she was opening a convent up in northwestern New Mexico, and they flew myself and a photographer up there to write about it. And while there, guess who flew Mother Teresa up to northwestern New Mexico? Charlie Keating. But yeah, lots of people. You know, I mean, I spent a lot of time doing child welfare in the last decade. And those stories stick with me because they are intensely human and usually fraught with a lot of, you know, drama and emotion. And I keep in touch with some of the folks that I've reported on from that era.
Let me ask you about your time at the state capitol, because you've had a few different stints there over, you know, the course of a few different decades. And I'm wondering, when you look at, for example, the way the legislature works now, and you think about it in, you know, sort of generations past with different governors, different crops of lawmakers, what do you think are some of the biggest differences now to the way it had been in the past?
As I first went out to the legislature after Fife Symington was elected governor, so that was 1991, you know, so I wasn't there for the days that people talk about, when we all, you know, we put our political differences aside, and you know, Sandra Day O'Connor talked a lot about that from her time in the legislature, but that was well before I got out there. But I would say if you look at it where we're at today, we are intensely, the legislature is very partisan. The specter of bipartisanship is a hard one to conjure up on anything that's of great significance. It's made a difference having a divided government with, in this case, a Democrat in the governor's seat and a Republican legislature that has forced some compromise, which, you know, hopefully is for the betterment of Arizona. But I would say that what struck me most is that the partisanship, and then things are just more locked down. And that's, I mean, physically locked down. Mm. I mean, Mark, when you and I were out there at one time, we could walk down the halls.
Yeah, you could pretty much go anywhere.
Yeah, talk to the members. You can't do that now.
Yeah.
And I understand that, you know, there's security concerns, but it makes it a little more difficult to get people to trust you because trust is built on interactions. And when your interaction is limited and you're reduced to text messaging or, you know, leaving voice messages, it's harder to develop those kind of relationships where you might have a trusting relationship and to understand issues.
Yeah. When you got here from Nebraska, did you think you would still be here all these years later?
Oh, goodness, no. It was my first job out of college from the University of Nebraska. And I thought, oh, I'll work here and then I'll get on with the Associated Press. And then I will get the AP to send me to their foreign desk. And then eventually, because I have these wonderful French language skills, I will be, you know, dispatched to some French-speaking foreign country. And guess what? That never happened. I never intended to stay, but dang, this is a great state for news. There's just so much going on, the growth in the state, the environmental challenges, you know, the time I spent with education, the politics, of course,
we're nationally known.
Yeah.
What do you think about when you've been at the Republic this whole time, which has obviously had some changes, especially over the last, you know, number of years here. How has sort of being there over the last, let's say, 8 to 10 years been different than when you first got there?
Oh, well, we've seen a shrinking of the staff, you know, and which is happening not just at the Arizona Republic, but, you know, especially at a lot of legacy mainstream newspapers, but also in the journalism realm writ large. So you've just learned to, you know, roll with it.
Do you think that shrinking will continue?
It's really hot. Yeah, probably. I mean, I think it's somewhat inevitable while we try to learn other ways to get the news out and try to do it in a quick and meaningful way. But it does seem to be the way that we're going. And I certainly hope that the Arizona Republic stays around for a long, long, long time. I'm a big walker in my neighborhood. I used to see a fair amount of driveways with newspapers. Very, very few.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you, when you saw those papers, would you put a little sticky note on them saying your neighbor, checkout page like A6, your neighbor wrote that?
No, but I remember once being at the vet to pick up our cat, and she was in a kennel, and there was a newspaper lining the floor, and it had my line on it. Just a coincidence.
Oh, no.
It was a very humbling moment to make you realize like how temporary, you know, news is. We write it, people digest it, and you move on.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Do you have moments when you think back on your career that you are the most proud of or that like really stand out to you? Like, that was really good. I'm really happy with that. I'm really glad I got to do that.
Yeah, I think when I look back, I think covering the 1990 gubernatorial campaign. And
there was Symington and Terry Goddard.
Yeah, which was sort of epic because it had to go to a runoff, which had never happened before, has not happened since. So a lot of drama there. And then covering that, especially that first term of Symington, you know, a businessman who came into office who wound up having a lot of real estate problems at the same time. I really look back, it was a very intense time for me, but I'm proud of the coverage that I did. And I'm proud of some of the work that we did with child welfare, trying to raise awareness about the challenges that the system has and that Arizona families have.
All right. That is Mary Jo Pitzel, longtime reporter with the Arizona Republic. Mary Jo, thank you so much for everything. We really appreciate
it. Well, thanks for the conversation.
Thank you.
Every week on the show for years, we heard from the editorial board of the Arizona Republic. But after that latest round of buyouts at our state's paper of record, the Republic's current editorial board is nearly gone. Now, you might think losing opinion writers is better than losing people who report the news, but newspapers were founded on editorials. Their boards have a rich history of writing unsigned columns with an institutional voice, endorsing presidential candidates, coming down against immigration policies, encouraging participation in elections. Their opinion columnists have weighed in on the biggest issues facing their communities, from politics to water to policy fights at the state legislature, with a keen eye and informed perspectives. From editorial pages, the editorial pages of our local newspaper gave us what our next guest calls moral clarity in shaping public opinion. Paul Fahrey is a longtime journalist. He spent 35 years at the Washington Post and now writes about the media for places like Columbia Journalism Review, The Atlantic, and Vanity Fair. Last year, he wrote about the long, slow death of the newspaper editorial for Nieman Reports, and I spoke with him more about it.
If you go down the list of what the most read parts of a newspaper are, editorials, it turns out, and op-ed columns aren't the most read. They're at the bottom. It depends on the paper, of course. And so if you are looking for the next round of cutbacks, which every newspaper is, that's the one you're going to start looking at. But, you know, I would argue that that's the heart and the lungs of a newspaper. It's what newspapers got started for. They also obviously cover the news, but they also are active institutional voices in their communities.
Yeah.
So I find this trend very sad.
I want to talk about that phrase that you just said, institutional voices in a community, right? Like, that strikes me as very, I guess, apropos to what's happening today, because we're in an era in which anything to do with an institution of any kind seems to be questioned, mistrusted. Are we seeing that kind of mistrust in the public?
Yes, of course. You have great polarization, which is one of the reasons why editorials are fading, too, is because half the people who read the editorial are going to disagree with you instantaneously, usually. And newspapers don't want to court controversy, particularly. They don't want to alienate people, particularly, given the situation. They're not the powerful institutions they used to be. And they want to be out of the business of making people upset, even though making people upset might be the best thing you could do for a community. There is less and less of an institutional voice, whether it's a newspaper, the politicians in the community, the homeowners association, whomever it is, there are fewer and fewer institutions to rely on. And, you know, newspapers used to be one of the pillars of those communities. They are no longer.
Let me ask you about what you think is lost in that, right? Like, we used to speak to someone at the editorial board of the Republic every week on the show, and they would often be able to talk about and weigh in on, with an opinion, lots of the kind of big issues facing the community, the challenges facing the community, whatever controversy seemed to be happening here right now. They would weigh in on that. You referred to this as kind of offering moral clarity, especially on big issues for communities.
Yeah, that's right. There aren't many people whose job is to be invested in and aware of and knowledgeable about a community and its all of its issues, the policing issues, education issues, political issues, what have you. That's what editorial boards did and have done for decades and even centuries. These are professional people whose job is to pay attention and perhaps to render an opinion about that. And that's a very valuable thing. When an editorial is really good, it's not just an opinion, it's explanatory. Mm-hmm. Here's the issue. Let me lay out the sides for you. Let's weigh the pros and cons and let's come to conclusions. And that's what the best editorials have done for a very long time. And it helps galvanize a community. It helps lead a community. It helps a community understand which way it should go, how it should spend its money, who it should elect, and what its values might be. And unfortunately, that's breaking down. People don't want to hear it. They've got their own opinions and they've got their own sources. And, you know, there's a whole body of literature and research about people living in their own opinion bubbles without wanting to hear from another side. And editorials are declining as a result of that as well.
So, I mean, we don't know what will replace the editorial board and the columnists at the Arizona Republic, but a lot of places, a lot of papers have seen this replaced with, you know, opinion pieces submitted by a lawmaker or an interest group or whoever it may be who wants to write an opinion about what's going on in their world. What's the difference between having an editorial board and publishing columns from other folks?
Yeah, Gannett, the owner of the Republic, is the leader in this. If you want to call it leadership, I'd call it a kind of chicken strategy, because basically what they're doing is saying, we don't want to render an institutional judgment. We don't want to have an editorial board that tells you what to think, but we'll allow, you know, the top Republican or the top Democrat or the school board president or the labor union leader to weigh in, and we'll quote unquote convene a conversation. But what's chicken about that is we'll lay off the opinion mongering to that person. And if you're mad about what he says, you don't blame us. Go and blame him. So this in some ways is a business strategy. It becomes, let's take the heat off ourselves. Let's not, you know, be leaders in our community. Let's let other people do the job that we did for many, many years. And it's such a disappointment to see that we're, you know, this notion of convening conversations is great, but that's actually what newspapers did when they invented the op-ed page. The op-ed page was you can be opposite the editorial board with a different opinion. So you had both. You had the institutional voice and you had the individual voice side by side. Now you've lost the institutional voice, and all you're going to get is the individual voice through these op-eds.
Paul, are there people out there who are thinking about editorials and editorial boards and opinion pages in a new way that you think is worth considering?
Well, it's really not so new, but in the digital world, there's plenty of publications dedicated to opinion and nothing but opinion. And actually, it's a flourishing world. It tends to be about national issues. You don't find out what's happening down the street from you. You don't have opinions about your local issues. It's more about what the president is up to or not up to or should be up to. But there's a great flowering of opinion that way. But the reason I say this isn't particularly new is because if you go back to the beginning of the Republic, if you go back to before the beginning of the Republic, there were plenty of printed newspapers that were nothing but opinion sheets. Common Sense, which was Thomas Paine's publication advocating for rebellion against the British, predates the founding of the Republic. And these are times that try men's souls was the famous line from Thomas Paine's Common Sense. So we've had printed newspapers with opinions for hundreds and hundreds of years, even before we became a country. And it has moved into the digital world. Unfortunately, it has not moved in any substantial way into the local world. And that's what we've lost.
All right. We'll have to leave it there for now. That is Paul Fahrey, a longtime journalist with The Washington Post, now a freelance writer who covers news media. Paul, thank you very much for coming on and reflecting on this with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Lauren.
We also reached out to Gannett about this segment and their plans for the future editorial pages of the Arizona Republic. They told us the paper maintains an editorial board and sent us a statement saying, quote, USA Today and the USA Today Network's editorial approach reinforces our commitment to inform and share diverse opinions. Our editorial teams encourage respectful and thoughtful dialogue as we share civil discourse from opposing points of view to engage constructive conversation.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Sam Dingman.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how pop music is once again defining the color of the summer.
But first, back in 1980, Dora Rodriguez was one of 30 migrants who crossed the border into the United States, seeking refuge from the increasingly oppressive regime in El Salvador. The group entered Arizona from the southwest and made it as far as Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument before they ran out of water and were abandoned by the guides they had paid to usher them to safety. Lost in the desert, the group endured days of starvation and violence before they were found. Only 13 of them survived, including Dora. The image of Dora's near-lifeless body being carried out of the desert appeared on the front page of newspapers and sparked a movement to offer sanctuary to refugees from Latin America. Dora herself went on to raise a family and founded a nonprofit called SalvaVision, which connects migrants and deportees with various forms of aid. But for decades, Dora kept the story of her border crossing to herself. Then, in 2016, dismayed by language from politicians that characterized migrants as criminals, she decided it was time to tell her story. And now she's published a memoir called Dora, A Daughter of Unforgiving Terrain. She will be speaking at Changing Hands this evening. When I read Dora's book, I was struck by a scene early in the story when Dora was still a teenager living in El Salvador. She wrote about a song she used to listen to called Las Casas de Cartón. When we spoke, I began our conversation by asking her about it.
That particular song brought to us like the sentiment of a fight. Uh-huh. And it was also used a lot on protest.
Yeah.
When the university of my town, which is was Santa Ana, were out there in the streets protesting the disappearance of students. Mm-hmm. And they will use that song with big speakers, loud speakers. For me personally, it had a big impact.
Dora, do you remember how the song went? Would you be able to hum a few bars of it for us?
In Spanish?
Sure, yeah, yeah.
Sí, decía, qué triste vive la gente en las casas de cartón. I am not a good singer.
No, that was wonderful. That's wonderful. Thank you.
It says, it's so sad to see my people in the houses or car boxes.
Meaning like sent away on trains?
Yes.
So then, as you write in the book, there comes a time when your mom warns you that you have to destroy this record, right, that you used to listen to, this record that had a recording of the song?
Yes, it was a particular afternoon that we were listening after school. And my mother came running and said, you guys need to destroy this because they're searching for homes. And that was a very common practice to just kick the door open for people from the government and go in your house without any warning and just check everything you had in your house. So my brother and I, we were together listening to the song, and I grabbed it from his hand, and we had toilets, and we just destroyed it in pieces and threw him in there. Wow. And within minutes, the soldiers start knocking on our door.
Wow.
And I am sure my brother and I were still shaking, but we were composed, and we said, come on in, check. We don't have nothing to hide.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Dora. I mean, that scene for me was such a palpable illustration of the level of paranoia that you had to live with.
Yes, we did. As a young people, every day, every weekend, we would go to, you know, outside towns, walking, just hiking. But you can no longer do those kind of things because things were drastically changing.
Yeah.
in our community. And all you saw was trucks full of soldiers pointing guns, rifles, and it's very scary.
So at a certain point, as you write about, you, in conversation with your mom, decide that it would be better for you to try to get to the United States. And one of the things that you talk about is that you and your family had realized not just that it would be better for you to be in the United States, but that it would be safer for your family for you to be in the United States.
Yes, because I was the oldest one. And I was, from my three siblings, I was the more spoken and vocal and involved mm-hmm. in community activities.
Right.
So, and my mother was afraid that because they were going to come after me or they were going to look for me because my association with the Mary Knoll Sisters.
Yeah. And tell us, the Mary Knoll Sisters were a charitable organization that you were working with, right?
Yeah, the Marino sisters were American nuns. They were placed in very marginalized communities in our country at that time to organize, not against the government, but to organize to make our communities better.
Yeah.
Like for us, we were trying to get a park going. We finished the park because of their support.
This is something you talk about very compellingly in the book, is this sense that even if the work that you were doing on behalf of people in the community had nothing to do with politics, even if it was just,
right,
as you said, trying to make life a little bit better, the
right
government at the time was so paranoid that that might indicate that you had sympathies with revolutionaries that they were killing people in the streets.
Yes.
So as a result of all this, as we were alluding to a moment ago, you do decide to leave and try to make it to the United States. It took three attempts to get here, and much of the book is focused on that third attempt, which, though it was ultimately successful, is an unbelievably difficult story to read. And you're so honest about the horrors that you survived trying to make it through the desert with the other people who you were with.
Yeah. When you go through a tragedy like that, I believe in your life, it's just you have it for the rest of your life.
Yeah.
But I was able to place it in a compartment in my heart, in my brain, in my soul, that it wouldn't attack me every day to survive. But I always had that in my mind that someday, before I got too old, I wanted it to put this in a book. It has not been easy.
Yeah.
It's been hard. I, in the process of writing, I would have woke up at midnight and, you know, just crying and scared and thinking, well, it was there. It never went away.
Well, and just to give listeners a sense of what we're talking about here, and a warning, you know, this is very difficult to hear, but, you know, you're writing about it because it's important. You talk about reaching the point where you and your fellow travelers had to drink your own urine to survive because there was so little water. You talk about some people being so exhausted from the heat and feeling so lost and hopeless that you would ever make it to your destination that they started asking each other just to let them die there in the desert. You write about one of the people you were traveling with starting to sexually assault the other women on the trip. It's just awful. But I got the sense from the way that you wrote about it in such a clear-eyed way that it was important to you for people to realize.
Yes, and I opened my story to the world because I felt morally obligated to humanize who we are and why people leave their countries. I want people to know that behind each family, behind each person that is criminalized and arrested and put in detentions and separated, it is a family. It is a whole family, a whole community that suffers.
Well, Dora Rodriguez is the director and co-founder of SalvaVision, but also the author of the new memoir, Dora, A Daughter of Unforgiving Terrain. Dora, thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman.
After years of mounting fears of COVID-19 and hopes for a vaccine to prevent it, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention has reversed course. Under the leadership of vaccine skeptic Robert F. Kennedy Jr., the agency has significantly narrowed its recommendations for who should get a COVID booster. He's fired and replaced a panel of health experts who advise the CDC on vaccines. And there are reports that he fired the CDC's former director over her views on vaccines. vaccines. So can you get a booster this fall? Should you? Here to explain is Will Humble, executive director of the Arizona Public Health Association and former director of the Arizona Department of Health Services. Good morning there, Will.
Hey, good morning. That was a really good intro.
Thank you for that. So let's start, Will, with kind of the news that we can all use here, right? Like, who should get a COVID booster this fall?
Yeah, pretty much anybody who has, well, everyone over 65, anybody who has frequent contact with people that are vulnerable. So, for example, anybody who's around grandparents or anybody who's around people with special needs, anybody with chronic medical conditions that put them at higher risk, pregnant women. So pretty much everybody would benefit. I'm going to encourage everyone in my family to get the vaccine. So that's, you asked the question, who should?
That's the next question, right? Like, who can now get this COVID booster under this changed and really narrowed guidance?
So far, the only clear group of people that for sure will be able to get the COVID-19 booster this year are people over 65. That part's clear. I don't think the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices, they're going to meet in a couple of weeks, they're not going to end that recommendation. So that's the who can. Mm-hmm. Depending on what ACIP, that's the acronym for that group, depending on what they decide in a couple of weeks, that'll really drive who else will be able to get the vaccine and what they have to do to get it. So, for example, they could decide they would recommend the vaccine for people under 65 with some kind of medical condition, mm-hmm. but they could couch that with that they need a prescription to prove that. Mm-hmm. They might not put the prescription part in there. We just don't know what that committee's going to do. I wish I could give you better answers to these questions, but it's also up in the air until that group meets in a couple of weeks.
Is that a little late in terms of kind of the fall vaccine season here?
Yeah, it's pretty late. The vaccine manufacturers have already, they're making the vaccine now. Some is ready and in warehouses. But one of the things that's so complicated about all this and doing this late in the season, as you suggest, is like, this doesn't magically happen. CVS, Walgreens, doctor's offices, they have to order the vaccine. It doesn't just come. They have to order it and pay for it. And they don't know what to order because they don't know what ACIP, that advisory committee, is going to do. They don't know what the CDC director is going to do after that committee makes their decision on COVID. And by the way, they're going to review other vaccines like RSV and hepatitis B and stuff in 2 weeks. So it's so complicated that people don't know what to order. And then listeners, people out there, they don't know whether they'll be able to get it or not, or if they do get it, how they're going to get it, and will their health plan pay for it? All that's up in the air.
Will, what about the role of pharmacies in this and how they're determining what could happen going forward?
Well, that's a really super important question because over the last few years, more and more people, maybe the majority of people, have gotten used to getting their vaccines in pharmacies. And whether or not a pharmacist in Arizona can administer a vaccine requires that vaccine to be recommended by the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices for that person. So right now, as it stands, pharmacists would only be able to administer the vaccine to people over 65. Even if a person under 65's health plan would cover it, even if they had a prescription, they wouldn't be able to do it. So one of the things that could happen is after the advisory committee meets, there's a couple of options that the state health department has to broaden access at pharmacies. For example, the chief medical officer at the state health department could issue what's called a standing order, mm-hmm. which would then basically provide people with that prescription without a clinical visit. They could then use that to take it into the pharmacy, and then the pharmacist would be authorized to provide that vaccine. So there are some loopholes that we can exploit in Arizona that's already existing inside of state law if the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices and the CDC make some really bad decisions later in the month.
What about the public health side of this? What are your concerns?
Well, that's really the main concern is that when you limit access to this really important vaccine that prevents hospitalizations, the people that are the most vulnerable are always the people that are going to suffer the most. So seniors, people with chronic medical conditions that put them at higher risk, all of them will be more likely to be exposed out in the community because it's, you know, been restricted and there'll be more virus circulating that otherwise would have been. So, yeah, it's a public health concern.
What about for kids, Will? I know that in maybe European countries and other countries, there have been different guidelines on whether or not kids really need a COVID booster. What are your thoughts there?
Well, if I, my kids are all adults now, but if I had little kids, I'd still be encouraging them to get the vaccine. I'd bring them down and make them get the vaccine,
right,
actually. And for two reasons. Number one, if you have a choice of being infected or not infected, even if you're at low risk, of course, I would choose having my kids not to get infected. Number two, you know, my parents are in their 90s and my kids would be around them and older people. And I feel like I have an obligation to do everything I can to prevent my kids from bringing the virus out into the community to infect other people that are at higher risk.
We're seeing so much change right now in terms of public health policy on vaccines. Florida just announced they're getting rid of vaccine mandates in schools. I wonder what you make of that broader context right now and how it could affect populations like ours here in Arizona, which already kind of struggles with lower than average immunization rates for kids, right?
Yeah. So Arizona is, we're not the lowest, but we're in the bottom tier of states with respect to childhood immunization rates. I don't expect Governor Hobbs to do anything like what they're doing in Florida, nor would Sheila Sholander, who runs the state health department right now. She would never go along with something like what they're doing in Florida, but all that could change. You know, these kinds of political decisions that are not based on evidence or science could change, you know, with a new governor. I mean, we'll just have to see.
Yeah. Three states, Will, just announced on the West Coast that they're bucking the CDC guidance here. They're going to form their own health alliance to give their own vaccine guidance. These are left-leaning states, California, Oregon, Washington. I wonder what you make of that and sort of the fracturing of vaccine guidance and what it might mean for, I guess, our national public health going forward.
Yeah, I mean, those West Coast states that are doing that, using their own state authority to do whatever they can is a good thing. But take, for example, the decisions that are made by the Advisory Committee for Immunization Practices and CDC. That really rolls into what health insurance plans pay for or not, including Medicaid and Indian Health Services. So those states can make those decisions, and it may change who can get the vaccine a little bit in those states. But in terms of broad policy, it has to be it's a national thing because reimbursement is tied nationally to the Vaccines for Children program. And, you know, the Affordable Care Act in terms of what health plans are required to cover.
Okay, we'll leave it there. That is Will Humble, Executive Director of the Arizona Public Health Association, joining us with what we know now in terms of vaccine guidance this fall. Will, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Much like certain songs and movies come to define the zeitgeist every summer, so too do colors. And like the songs and movies that come to encapsulate the cultural moment, it's usually hard to predict which color will emerge as the dominant hue in social media posts, clothes, and accessories. 2024 was, of course, the summer of bright green, inspired by the Charlie XCX album Brat. And our next guest says this year is looking like it might be defined by another pop music phenomenon. Amanda Kerberg studies digital culture at ASU. She is our resident culture expert. Amanda, good morning.
Good morning.
So tell us about this color and this artist that you think are looming on the horizon.
Oh, I imagine listeners can guess. We're talking Taylor Swift. We're talking Swiftynomics, The Life of a Showgirl album dropping on October 3rd. And we have this moment now where we can safely say orange is the new brat.
Orange is the new brat. I love it. I love it. So what do you take away from this orange color? What are some associations there?
So orange is generally known in brand psychology as this energetic, lively, excited, really, really friendly color. Also known, you know, if anybody has ever had your aura photo taken in Sedona, like me, I can't relate to the orange one. I always have a shocking bold red color. But orange also for people is this lively, friendly color. And according to Taylor Swift, that's what her life has been like lately. Mm-hmm. Her new life with, you know, Kansas City Chiefs, Travis Kelce. My theory, of course, is that if you look at the blur of the last 2 years into the Kansas City Chiefs colors of red and gold, and you mix those together, you get a kind of Portofino orange glitter that we're talking on this new album.
So what are some other places we have seen this orange hue crop up since her album reveal?
Yeah. So this is what happens every time, like, some new color just takes over the zeitgeist. Everybody scrambles to participate in some way. So, of course, we've got, you know, the local Kansas City Union Station went orange, but we also had the Empire State Building go orange. X, Google, Canva, brands across fashion and food posted orange content, M&Ms. But I have to say, the people who had it the best are pretty much every social media manager who woke up in Texas that day. Just orange you glad you don't have to change your brand colors at all. Just Whataburger, Texas Longhorns.
Right, they're
pretty happy people.
Well, so what do you think is behind, because as you were just pointing out, we see this phenomenon all the time where brands, social media headers, people change their traditional color schemes to associate themselves with this new color that, say, a popular artist is expressing. What do you think is behind that urge to kind of align yourself or associate yourself with that color?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, that's the classic thing, right? If we can, like, steal a little bit of that feeling that you have about an artist, about an entertainment product, about a new song, whatever it is, we can associate that happy emotion that you have with them with our brand. You yeah. just feel a little bit of that today for M&Ms or for Balenciaga. It's just a way, I think, to get to make your brand feel a little bit new and fresh and involved in the conversation, even if, of course, you're not going to long-term change those colors. Because
right.
the fact that they're steady and reliable as the colors they are is also important.
Yeah.
But, yeah, social media, because it's a changing conversation every day, really lends itself to, oh, we need to find ways to connect with people today and, of course, tomorrow in the long term.
You know, I have to say, something I'm thinking about as we're talking about this is, you know, as a millennial public radio host, I'm contractually obligated to be into vinyl. and I sometimes find myself having this sort of crusty conversation like, you know, nobody cares about album art anymore. It doesn't really matter. But, you know, between Charlie XCX and Taylor Swift, there is a sense, it seems like, that an artist with a really strong vision can still drive not just the cultural conversation, but kind of cause us to see the world through their eyes a little bit.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think that, I mean, as a millennial public radio listener, I agree. Also contractually obligated to be into vinyl. I've got Sabrina Carpenter's new album on me on the way right now. And I think, yeah, it really is shaping the conversation now in a way that I feel like it hasn't in a while. But so when these new album covers drop and then we wait for all of the different versions to, it becomes a way to shape the conversation both aesthetically and thematically as well. I think Sabrina Carpenter's definitely led the discourse very much thematically in recent months.
Yes.
While in the case of, Brat Summer and then now Taylor Swift's Orange, it's been very much an aesthetic disruptor. And it has been a disruptor. I mean, if you look at, like, what Pantone thought the color of the year was going to be. We had Mocha Mousse, Pinterest, based on all, you know, their aggregation of everybody's clicks and cues, thought it would be Dark Cherry.
Huh.
Nothing matters. Nothing yeah. matters when Taylor Swift enters the conversation.
right. Crowds out everything else. Well, the other thing that I think is interesting about these colors like orange, green, these are very, like, bright, attention-grabbing colors, which seems like a bit of a departure from the so-called millennial gray phenomenon.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. No, I swear I can't open TikTok now without some bright-eyed Gen Z person completely demolishing a millennial gray kitchen. We had so much gray in our lives. I mean, I think we had, you know, not to get too dark, but I think we had a lot of gray in our lives thematically.
Mm-hmm.
And then the movie desaturation that we saw across cinema in the 2000s and the early 2010s, I mean, there was just a specific aesthetic that was really, really pushed against bright, saturated colors. And so we're seeing such a response to that now. We're talking about these really, really bright greens or that we saw even with Billie Eilish, the yellows that we've seen come from artists like Rihanna and Beyonce. I mean, these are just bright, bold, saturated colors. And that is a very different vibe then. Yeah.
Well, we'll be keeping an eye on the orange as we head into fall. That is the show's pop culture expert, Amanda Kerberg. Amanda, thank you as always.
Thank you so much, Sam.
All right, that's it for this Thursday edition of the show. Join Mark tomorrow morning with the Friday Newscap, as always. And if you've ever wanted to see the show live, we are doing it. We're putting it on stage. It is September 14th at Crescent Ballroom. Mark your calendar. Go to rsvp.kjzz.org for more info. We would love to see you there.
And if even that is not enough show for you, we also want to remind you about the show's weekly newsletter, Radioheads, which you can sign up for at theshow.kjzz.org. Of course, we've always got way more to tell you about than we have time to fit into the hour, and the newsletter is where you can find it.
That's right. All right, for Sam Dingman and Mark Brody, I am Lauren Gilger. Thanks for joining us. That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.